Good morning, this is Brian Trumbore with your Week in Review for Saturday, January 30th. Let's talk about the State of the Union, including Wall Street. I got a little depressed watching President Obama Wednesday night. I gave him a fair shot for about the first 6 months of his initial year in office, and let's face it, we were on the verge of a depression, and we aren't today. Seeing as we avoided Armageddon thus far, and we did so under his watch, Obama gets some credit on this front. And the president deserves credit for not caving when it comes to Afghanistan, as well as letting the CIA do its thing when it comes to all the drone attacks against Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And for this last bit in particular, he deserves a lot of credit, far more than he is receiving. A few years ago, the president wrote a piece for Foreign Affairs that is on my Hotspots link, and I noted at the time that parts of it sounded almost Kennedy-esque. President Kennedy having a foreign policy that was largely to be admired for the time in which he was serving. But as for the rest, Obama's agenda and his persona, I grow weary. I just get the sense he really doesn't like us, or rather it's almost a certain disdain that shines through, as if he's disappointed he has to share his orbit, thinking it beneath him. I mean, take the State of the Union and his appearances afterward, where he keeps saying that if he was interested in the poll numbers and just running for re-election, as he chastened both parties, then he wouldn't be taking the unpopular stands he is today because, you see, only he knows what's best and only he is truly acting in our nation's best interest. If you had been in a coma for 2 years and hadn't heard the campaign rhetoric, let alone his 6,000 speeches since taking office, you could have listened to much of the State of the Union and nodded your head in agreement. Yet the facts speak otherwise, and I'm going to be fixated on one single issue the rest of his days in office unless there's a change in how he conducts himself, that being the way he handled health care. How can our president say that if he was interested in the polls or winning elections, he wouldn't have been focused on health care the way he has been when, as George Will nailed it a few weeks ago, the whole process to date has been nothing less than serial corruption? I can't help but repeat myself from the past 2 weeks, but for me and millions of others, the final straw was the backroom deal for the unions and their Cadillac plans, let alone the dirty deals for Louisiana Senator Mary Landrieu and Nebraska's Ben Nelson. How can Obama possibly stand before us with a straight face and act as if the process was pure? So I'm sorry, the president has lost me. I do, however, promise to be as fair as possible in this ongoing history of the 21st century that I'm compiling. But here's another issue that is of rather major importance. President Obama's handling of Iran and its nuclear weapons program. First, Obama set a deadline of last September for Tehran to cease enriching uranium, per three prior UN Security Council resolutions. Then the deadline was reset to December. Now, the United States, a few days removed from February, is frantically trying to line up Russia and China for further sanctions that do nothing more than target Iran's financial institutions and some Revolutionary Guard higher-ups. Hardly the stuff that will keep Iran from plowing ahead. Admittedly, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said the other day Moscow's patience with Iran was running out, and maybe China will abstain rather than issue a veto in the Security Council, but the bottom line is Iran's brilliant stall game continues apace. So President Obama, on an issue that threatens the security of the entire free world, said this of both Iran and North Korea on Wednesday. Speaking about getting the world to secure, quote, all vulnerable nuclear materials, in 4 years so that they never fall into the hands of terrorists, Obama continued, these diplomatic efforts have also strengthened our hand in dealing with those nations that insist on violating international agreements in pursuit of these weapons. That is why North Korea now faces increased isolation and stronger sanctions, sanctions that are vigorously enforced. That is why the international community is more united and the Islamic Republic of Iran is more isolated. And as Iran's leaders continue to ignore their obligations, there should be no doubt. They, too, will face growing consequences. Well, that was it. Nothing about the fraudulent election or the heroic demonstrators. I'll comment later, but for now, more opinion on the State of the Union. Michael Gerson, Washington Post. From the text of the speech itself, it was difficult to discern an ideology, not because of its moderation, but because of its contradictions. The president took credit for the stimulus package, demanded another one, and called for budget restraint. After a year of delaying other legislative priorities in a single-minded pursuit of health reform, Obama challenged Congress on fiscal reform and other matters. How long should we wait? Obama attributed the hated bank bailout to his predecessor, then insisted it had saved the economy, which he chalked up to his own everlasting credit. There were policy proposals along the whole ideological rainbow, tax increases and tax cuts, new spending and a budget freeze, cap and trade and oil exploration. These tensions were reflected in the president's tone. He showed Reagan-like optimism about America's future and Carter-like worry about America's deficit of trust and deep and corrosive doubts. He urged our politics to get beyond the same tired battles, while repeatedly turning to those battles in his self-excusing blame of the past. He will not give up on trying to change the tone of our politics, while making liberal use of partisan sarcasm. Michael Gerson continues, there was only one scheme that united all these various arguments and attitudes, the president's unshakable self-regard. He admits miscalculations, but he's never wrong. He changes his strategy, but not his mind. On health reform, quote, I take my share of the blame for not explaining it more clearly to the American people. If only Obama had made a few more speeches, Americans would have been delivered from their misconceptions. Even Obama's apologies are unapologetic. He is like the job candidate discussing his flaws during an interview. I have to admit, I work too hard. I'm too detail-oriented. The speech also raises concerns about Obama's capacity to be a unifying national leader. An effective leader usually shares the passions and purposes of his countrymen. Rhetorically, Obama attempts to stand above the political process, above his own party, even above the country. He seems isolated in the tower of his own wisdom and purity. He judges. He lectures. We must strive to be worthy of him, not he of us. Americans no doubt deserve some of Principal Obama's reprimands, but when scolded, will they follow him? That was Michael Gerson. George Will, Washington Post. Not until the 33rd minute of Wednesday's 70-minute address did Obama mention health care. The weirdness of what he said made it worth the wait. Acknowledging that the longer the public has looked at the legislation, the less the public has liked it, he blamed himself for not explaining it more clearly. But his faux contrition actually blames the public. The problem is not the legislation's substance, but the presentation of it to slow learners. He urged them to take another look at the plan we've proposed. The plan, the differences between the House and Senate plans are not trivial. They concern how to pay for the enormous new entitlement. Last February 24th, he said he had an activist agenda because of the recession, not because I believe in bigger government. I don't. 97 days later, he bought General Motors. George Will continues, Wednesday night's debut of Obama as avenging angel of populism featured one of those opaque phrases, the weight of our politics, that third-rate speechwriter slipped past drowsy editors. Obama seems to regret the existence in Washington of everyone else. He seems to feel entitled to have his way without tiresome interventions in the political process by the many interests affected by his agenda for radical expansion of the regulatory state. Obama's leitmotif is, Washington is disappointing, Washington is annoying, Washington is dysfunctional, Washington is corrupt. Verily, Washington is toxic, yet Washington should conscript a substantially larger share of GDP, and Washington should exercise vast new controls over healthcare, energy, K-12 education, etc. That was George Will. Turning to Wall Street, you can ignore the 5.7% flash GDP estimate for the fourth quarter that was released on Friday, the fastest pace since 2003. While there was some encouraging data on exports, consider that we learned wages and benefits for all of 2009 rose a meager 1.5%, the lowest such figure since records were kept in 1982. It's about labor, the consumer, and housing going forward, and I'm focused on what happens after the first quarter, which will be another positive showing, specifically from late spring on into 2011. I've told you that my main concern is we'll be overwhelmed by geopolitical events, and nothing has happened thus far in 2010 to change that stance one iota. But I've also said the fundamentals do not look good. And economist Nouriel Roubini, who is to be ignored when it comes to equity forecasts, but says some prescient things otherwise, nailed it when he said in Davos, Switzerland this week that, quote, the outlook for advanced economies is weak, and that there would be a shortage of demand in the world because, quote, the overspending countries are cutting back on consumption and the overproducing countries cannot rely on the overconsuming countries to spend. We are far from being out of the woods in the massive debts that governments in Europe, the United States, and parts of Latin America have been accumulating or finally coming home to roost, such as in the case of Greece or Spain, Rubini's prime flashpoint, or Portugal or Italy or Ireland, the preceding nations representing the pigs. I've been writing the past few months that the problem in the case of Greece, for example, is that the European Union doesn't have a mechanism in place for bailing out a corrupt, profligate nation. Yet that is exactly what the EU will have to do, or they're all going to hell. And Rubini's forecast that the Eurozone nations will abandon the euro in 2 or 3 years could be moved up some. PIMCO's Mohamed El Arian wrote in an op-ed for the Financial Times the following regarding Greece and the whole sovereign debt story. Most still think of Greece as an isolated case, just as they did Dubai a few months ago. With time, they will see Greece as part of a much larger investment theme that is a direct outcome of the global financial crisis. The 2008-09 ballooning of sovereign balance sheets in advanced economies is consequential and is becoming an important influence on valuations in many markets around the world. El Arian continues, at the simplest level, think of Greece as Europe's big game of chicken, with the operational question for markets being twofold. Who will blink first, the Greek authorities, donors, or both? And will they blink in time to avoid truly disorderly debt and market dynamics that also entail significant contagion risk? Over the next few days, we are likely to get some combination of Greek and European donor announcements aimed at calming markets, reducing volatility and reducing contagion risk. But the impact on markets is unlikely to be sustained as both sides face multi-round protracted challenges which contain all the elements of complex game dynamics. No matter how you view it, markets in Greece will remain volatile and more global investors will be paying attention. In the process, this will accelerate the more general recognition that sovereign balance sheets in many advanced economies are now in play when it comes to broad portfolio positioning consideration. That was Mohamed El Arian. To be continued. Undoubtedly next week. Meanwhile, except for the GDP and Chicago Purchasing Managers data, I thought the economic numbers, particularly on housing, were so-so at best. Both existing and new home sales for December were far below projections, though I'll grant you the lousy weather is a legitimate excuse for some of the underperformance. And December durable goods orders, while up, were far less than expected. Corporate earnings from the likes of Apple, Texas Instruments, Corning, Johnson & Johnson, Caterpillar, Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, Ford, 3M, and Amazon all beat. Well, that's good. Some of the accompanying statements were also pretty decent regarding future guidance, though Cat was symptomatic of the larger multinationals in stressing that prospects in Europe are tepid at best compared to those in Asia. So why'd the stock market fall for a third straight week? The sovereign debt issue. Uncertainty over Ben Bernanke gaining approval for a second term at the Federal Reserve, which he did. Concerns over a potential slowdown in China, unwarranted in my opinion, and most importantly, a general feeling of uncertainty as to the Obama administration's economic policies, and could they kill the recovery. So stocks slid a third straight week to finish the month of January on a solid down note, with all the major averages off over 3% since the first of the year. Because the world has changed and geopolitical events can influence the market at a moment's notice, I no longer believe in the old saw that as January goes, so goes the market. There are too many variables compared to the old days, but the other week I did post figures in my Wall Street History column, if you are still interested. I apologize for the slight delay with the recording this week. I'm testing out some new software. I should be back with you next Saturday. Have a great week.